Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman, and I am so delighted to be joined by Victor Laval today. I've been a fan for so long of the seven works of fiction that he's written, four novels, two novellas, and a collection of short stories. His novels have been included in Best of the Year lists by the New York Times Book Review, the LA Times, the Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, and more. He lives in the Bronx with his wife and kids and teaches at Columbia University. And his latest novel is called Lone Women. Welcome, Victor.
I'm happy to be here.
So before we even get going, I should say that I'm nervous to talk to you about this book because I don't want to spoil anything.
It is built for to be ruined by conversation.
I was almost contemplating having you on like in a couple of months after everybody's read it so I could ask you all. But this is our situation. So that's the So let's start with the title of the book, because the book cover image is so striking. It's a lone woman, one, standing in the plains of Montana. But the book title, of course, is plural.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, so the novel is a historical, gothic, horror, something kind of blend, but at heart, it is a really, really thoroughly researched book. And it's about women homesteaders who went out to Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, those kind of areas, and made claims on their own, meaning they were either single. The law of the time allowed for either single women or widows to make claims for land under their own name. And when they proved up after 3 years of living on the land, to own it in their own names, as opposed to like their husband signs off or their father or something like that. And they called these women lone women. And I just felt like, oh, okay. Well, actually, that's not entirely true. The original title of the book was going to be Proving Up. And then Karen Russell had a long story, I believe, called Proving Up, or like a novella called Proving Up. And I know better than to go into toe-to-toe with Karen Russell. I said, I got to change this title. And Lone Women actually turned out to, I felt like, was even more accurate to the mood and the theme. And I felt like it was also an interesting, you know, as you say, is how could it be plural? If it's a lone woman, how could it be plural? And then that's maybe one of the things that would be interesting.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you do so well in the book is just explain how lonely this homesteading was, and how you'd like to think, I probably in this age in America too, it was a real like rugged individualism moment, and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps all alone is incredibly difficult.
Very difficult. And in fact, there's a character I have somewhat early on say to her, like, because she's a Black, the main character is a Black woman coming to Montana alone. And she's getting a ride from a wagon man named Mr. Olson out to her claim. And she admits to him her concerns, like, number one, I'm a woman alone. Then even more specifically, I'm a Black woman out here in Montana alone, where there don't seem to be many, if any, others. And Mr. Olson says, while there are lots of prejudices floating all around, everyone here knows that this land is trying to kill them. And so everyone will help, because when they need help, they know they're going to need you. And in this weird sort of way, it creates it's not that everyone likes each other. It's not that everyone accepts each other. It's that everyone knows I'm going to die without some help.
Absolutely.
And that became a theme.
And I love that later on in the book, Adelaide says, actually, the land doesn't care about us. It's not trying to kill us.
Yes.
We came to this land.
Yes.
What were we expecting?
And yeah, I hope there. Thanks for catching that, because I felt like it was on some level the book is also about watching just Adelaide, who's lived in her previous life. She lived 31 years on the farm with her family under the care/thumb of her mother and father and the burdens of family. And so her coming out there is really, in a way, like a late coming of age kind of story as well. And I wanted that to be one of her revelations. It's like, we're not the center of any of this. And then on top of that, right, and this land is not a land for me. And what does that mean for me? And all the rest.
And of course, a perfect example of fake advertising is Adelaide in California has read about all of the opportunity in Minnesota and of course the wonderful weather.
Yes.
Which oops.
Thanks to the newsletter from a woman named Maddie Kramer, who was a real woman. She was a journalist who moved to Montana from Iowa, and she moved to Montana in 1908, and she worked on a newspaper in a small town there, and her writing was interesting enough or got enough attention that it came to the attention of the Great Northern Railway, and then they said to her, we'd love if you'd write a newsletter so other single women might know about the opportunities here. But of course, it's also advertising for, because you got to buy railway tickets to come out there. So they were deeply invested in her convincing people to come. And one of the people she convinced was Adelaide.
Yeah. When it comes to hiring, you need to trust your gut. But what if you could give your gut some help? When you want to find quality talent fast, you need Indeed. Indeed is the hiring platform where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. Don't spend hours on multiple job sites looking for candidates with the right skills when you can do it all with Indeed. Find top talent fast with Indeed's suite of powerful hiring tools like matching, assessments, and virtual interviews. Hate waiting? Indeed's U.S. data shows over 80% of Indeed employers find quality candidates whose resume on Indeed matches their job description the moment they sponsor the job. Indeed does the hard hiring work for you. Sponsor a job and we'll match you with quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your job description right when you post. With Indeed, you can start hiring fast. Join over 3 million businesses worldwide using Indeed to hire great talent fast. Indeed knows when you're growing your own business, you have to make every dollar count. That's why with Indeed, you only pay for quality applications that match your must-have job requirements. Visit Indeed.com/Maris to start hiring now. Just go to Indeed.com/Maris. Indeed.com/Maris. Terms and conditions apply. Cost per application pricing not available for everyone. Need to hire? You need Indeed. I sort of love that the time period, of course, it's 1915. And that's kind of an in-between time when, like, some places had electricity, but not all. Some people had cars, but not nearly all. And you are so good at making the setting desolate and dark. And I'm wondering, did you go to Montana to research this?
Well, I'd been through Montana years before, but honestly, like, I drove across the top of the country when I was moving back from Oakland to New York City. And I passed through Montana, fell in love with absolutely its beauty, but also got a taste for its desolation, you know, and it really never left me. That stayed with me. And then I came across this book many years later called Montana Women Homesteaders, edited by a woman named Sarah Carter. And in a way, it was just more like, as I was reading what the women homesteaders were going through, I could recall that place I'd been. And so I felt like, okay, maybe I can get a kind of a sense, even though that had been the summer, it still was bleak and desolate and beautiful. So I just kind of extrapolated from there. I admit I didn't go back. I couldn't. We had two younger kids. I just couldn't make it back.
100%. That's fair. I think one of the things that the images that stayed with me is that it's so flat there that at night when it's dark and in the winter when it's mostly dark, you can't really see anything unless there's perhaps a candle in a window somewhere.
Yes. And you can see a candle in a window in a home that's miles away because it's potentially literally the only light anywhere on the plains. It was interesting because I was thinking of it. It was almost like when you dive really deep and they talk about, like, if it gets dark down there, like, you you really can get lost and confused about which way is up. And like, you have to breathe out to follow the bubble that's solidity. Like, save yourself if you're really deep. And I felt like it was a similar thing, but how much more frightening that it's, or as frightening, that you're on solid ground. In theory, you know there's land out there, but it's just like a great blank shadow.
Yeah.
In a 10 by 10 foot cabin.
And it's, yeah, one of the things is just the idea of fixing up this cabin to withstand wind and to, you know, she was told that the well had water in it, and that wasn't entirely true.
Right.
Let's talk about Adelaide's previous life a little bit. She had been part of a small community in California.
So she was part of the Black farming community in Southern California. Specifically, she's in a place called Lucerne Valley. There are some towns out there that Victorville, Albertville, apparently now, I believe either Albertville or Victorville is now like a state park, but it was once a thriving Black farm community. And she's a part of that, this community that was drawn out to Southern California with the promise of, making air quotes, colonizing Southern California. And as is the case with Montana, the government was so desperate to have this land sort of settled, now that they'd removed the indigenous population or killed off the indigenous population, that they relaxed the rules in ways that was part of the surprise for me doing the research. Was I just always assumed, like, okay, white guys, that's who's getting this land entirely. And of course they did great. But then it said, like, no, women could come. And I said, like, okay, does that just mean white women? And they said, well, it does mean white women, but it also means Black women and Black men, not Chinese people, because there was an anti-Chinese exclusion act that existed at that time.
Right.
But the complexity of what was allowed was so surprising to me, because I think I had that, you know, that problem of the present, thinking the past is very simple and the present is complicated. And in fact, you know, past is pretty complicated.
The depictions of Westerns that we've seen in most of cinema are pretty simple too.
Pretty skewed, yes.
Pretty skewed. One of the things that Adelaide's mother says to her that really stuck with me is, a woman is a mule, she said. And one of the things that you do in this book is you show us how heavy the load is that Adelaide has to carry, inherited from her parents. Tell me even about, like, talking about the physicality of Adelaide's move from California to Montana.
One of the things that I, first, the woman who is a mule thing is definitely an allusion to Zora Neale Hurston. Their eyes were watching God. There's a line in there that is sort of a play on that, right? So that I wanted that to just kind of echo or ring a little bit. But it was also me channeling my grandmother, who's a Ugandan immigrant, but she was born in the early 1900s, early-ish 1900s, like maybe 1908, 1910, and lived a life of a lot of work, a lot of toil, even when she came to the U.S. and all the rest. And so really felt this deep conviction that a woman's life is just rough. You just got to find a way to make it through. And occasionally there's moments of joy, but it's just hard.
Right.
And that's what it is. And so I saw my mom sort of hear all that, but also hate it, you know, sort of like, well, that maybe that was Uganda, but I didn't come to the US for that. And then it was hard in certain ways. So there was that tension back and forth that I wanted to sort of tap into. But the way I felt like I would tap into it was literally through the body moving through space, and Adelaide's body moving through space, as a way to suggest, like, both her strength, but also the struggle and the burden that she is literally carrying with this steamer trunk that she's bringing with her, but also the burden of that kind of legacy that her mother is passing on to her, thinking in her own way, I'm helping you because I'm teaching you the real world, and not understanding that the real world may want to do this to me and demand this of me, but why should you want to do this to me? And that mother-daughter question feels like a rich one.
Yes. Yes. Another thing I wanted to ask you about Adelaide's previous life in California that I'm not familiar with is her favorite book that her father would read to her was The Tenant of Wildfell Hall by Anne Bronte.
Yes. It's a surprising Bronte pick.
Yeah, of all the Bronte picks.
Well, the main reason why I picked that as the book is because it's in its time, it was actually a really forward-thinking feminist novel. It's a really strong feminist novel. And the main idea, the thing that made it like a huge controversy in its time, is that there's a wife of a louse of a guy who he's a heavy drinker. He wastes their money. He's verbally and emotionally abusive. And then she has the audacity to leave him. And at that time, it was the most scandalous thing in the world to say that a woman should not put up with abuse, that she should leave. And I liked the idea that of all the Bronte books, it would be, number one, Anne doesn't get anywhere near the same love, right? Yes. And then two, that I felt like if anyone went back and checked out that book, you'd say, oh, that's so interesting that this Black farming family was reading this really forward-thinking feminist novel that, and then that it was Adelaide's favorite book would suggest, even though she's been living under the thumb of her parents and following the rules and being a dutiful daughter, there was a part of her that wanted to be free. And then this is the way it happened.
Absolutely. And then of course, that old familiar chestnut is you can never quite be free of your past.
You can't. I mean, it was a little on the nose even when I was writing it, but she's carrying a steamer trunk everywhere. You say, like, wherever you go, you bring your baggage, you know.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the town of Big Sandy a little bit. There is an opera house there.
Yes.
Two restaurants. But not much else. And how far does Adelaide live from the main stretch of town?
She's a ways away. She's about, I think it's like 14 miles from town, if I'm remembering correctly. I apologize. I'm forgetting my own book. But I think it's about that far. And that was the case with many of the towns where there was homesteading. There'd be this central town, someplace small. The population in the book is about 500, including townspeople and then all the people on their claims. The modern day Big Sandy, as of 2020, its census was 600 people. Hmm. So it remains a small, but seems like a lovely town. Right. And in my acknowledgments, I apologize to them for what I did to their town. And I hope they wouldn't take it too badly. But that's the town. And it is like the opera house is the sort of is a thing that as I was doing my research, I found in big places like Havre and Butte and Helena, there would be opera houses. But even in small towns, there would be opera houses, which can be translated as like just theaters, community right. theaters, like that kind of thing. But there was something about the fact that they never just called it community house or community theater or anything. They always said opera house. And there was this sense of the ways they were maybe is a sign of their ambition, but also their yearning to hold on to some kind of like imagined European beginnings or cultures or Eastern seaboard culture now that they were out in this place that was so desolate.
Absolutely. And then of course it works so well if you're going Gothic.
I mean, it doesn't hurt. When I found out that there were opera houses, I was like, oh, and we can bring the whole town in and there can be sets and the big, you know, the big denouement can happen there. And I said, oh, this is good.
Adelaide starts in California and ends in Montana, but has the same problem that people won't understand what is in the box. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about shame and when it's smart to worry about what other people think, because other people can be terribly dangerous.
Yes.
And when it's overwhelming in a bad way.
Well, like kind of the central question I was sort of ruminating over with the book was about like having a family secret or family secrets. And so, I mean, maybe to pull it back a bit, my family, we have more specifically, we have like a great deal of what would be called mental illness in the family in various generations, various ways. And there was a great deal of shame around the sort of erratic behavior and strange ways of members of our family who we're loved and we're a part of us and all the rest. And so the narrative we had was like, you never tell anyone, you never talk about it, you never admit to that kind of thing, right? Like nobody knows what goes on inside the house, right? And so I was raised with that. But then as I got older, a good bit older, one of the things I started to understand was everybody knew something was off, right? But in a way, because we agreed or refused to talk about it, we agreed not to talk about it, we kind of walled ourselves off from help,
right?
From safety, from perhaps somebody else saying, this isn't normal, you shouldn't go through this. Maybe they need help, that family member needs help, not to just be shut away,
right?
Or to be shut down. But there were all these healthy ways of living that were right outside our sort of walled city. But I didn't understand it until I had left the city, so to speak, you know? And so the book is very much about that idea of like, not only there being a family secret, but like the deeper revelation that it's pretty rare that families are actually keeping their secrets,
right,
from anyone but themselves, right? And that was kind of what, when with Adelaide traveling to Montana with nothing but her steamer trunk, she thinks, I have escaped, the family's behind me, my parents are dead, everything has happened there. That's not a spoiler, that's like the first 2-3 pages, I think, of the book. And so over here, I can start again. But then the more she's up there, the more other people can even see, what's wrong? What's with you? Why are you so secretive? Why you should keep us at an arm's length? All this kind of thing. And the process of the book in part is her learning that like shame was not only a source of shame, but also a method of control. And that there's something powerful about releasing the shameful secret and seeing if maybe rather than destroying you to have everyone know, it actually saves you.
I am sorry to admit that in reading this story as a fable of escaping some of that judgment, I couldn't help but think of all of the people that I wish could leave Florida and Texas like right now. So Adelaide's closest neighbors are Grace and Sam Price, and Sam is a little kid, and Grace is probably not someone who Adelaide would choose to make her best friend, but her choices are slim.
It's slim to none. I mean, if it's not going to be Grace, it's going to be nobody.
And it's fun to watch their relationship grow and change throughout the book.
I appreciate that. You know, it's funny. So my wife is listening to it now on audiobook, and the woman who's read it for the audiobook is wonderful. But one of the things she was laughing, she said, you know, one of the moments that I believed most about their friendship is the moment when, right at the beginning, when Grace shows up and is immediately criticizing all her choices about the house and all the things she's decided to do with her decor and everything. And then Adelaide has to just sit there for a moment and say, I'm going to either kick this woman out, or I'm going to choose to accept that this is the friend who judges everything I do, but she does show up for me. And my wife was like, I really believed that moment, but she has to decide like, what do I gain? What do I lose from this friendship? But this is who she is. And then on my end, on Adelaide's end, I'm the weird, isolated lady in the cabin. I don't know that I have a right to be pushing anyone away, you know, and that on some level, that's what friendships are built on, you know?
Absolutely. And one of the things I loved about the narrator, I listened to a bunch of it, is she's so great with the anachronisms. At one point in the book, Grace slaps the shit out of someone. Perfect moment. And it's like, well, we understand what happened there. The imagery is vivid.
I just felt like in that moment saying so, like she loosed her unbridled rage. It just was too delicate. He was like, no, she slapped the shit out of that lady. And you go, okay, I get it.
I'm wondering, so stop me if you don't want to talk about this, but I think you've discussed how this book is about a metaphorical monster, at least. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the sections that were written from the monster's perspective that look like poetry.
Yeah, well, so the original plan was, like, I originally wrote those sections in the same prose as everything else. And my editor, the wonderful Chris Jackson, he said, like, it seems off to me that a life that is so different from everyone else's would be related in the exact same way. And then, you know, in a weird way, one of the things I sort of like pulled back to was Beloved, how Beloved talks. And the idea that there's something, one of the ways you know that there's a different perspective is in the way that she communicates in the novel, because it is, at least certainly for a while, it is disjointed and strange, and it's part of the strangeness of Beloved coming back. And I kind of use that as an inspiration, saying like, yeah, it's got to be a vastly different way of communicating and understanding. And then what I tried was that sort of more lyrical, poetic sort of form, and it felt good. And what it also did was it suggested a much deeper being was inside there, regardless of what they might appear to be to other people, and that would be another layer of the tragedy, is that this is what was inside all along. And look at how that being was treated. You know, like somehow it's terrible for anything to be mistreated. But when you understand that there's a thinking, sentient being inside, it's even worse, because you go, oh my God, this is a person a thing I can understand went through this. And so that was the way that we came to that.
Well, I love that. I could ask you many more questions, but I will end this with asking you to recommend some books for us.
Yes. One of the books I'm going to recommend is someone who was a guest on your show, The Survivalists by Kashana Cawley. Yeah. I thought it was a wonderful book, and like for a debut novel. I mean, I know she wrote for The Daily Show, all of those stuff. So she is hardly, in my mind, like not a new writer, but I thought it was just a really confident and wonderful debut. That's been out for a little while. So the other one I would recommend is just out. It's a novel called The Strange by a writer named Nathan Ballingrud. And the best way to describe it, it's kind of sci-fi-ish. And it's essentially about a 13-year-old girl on Mars in the future, on a settlement on Mars in the future. And the way I think they describe it that's really great is True Grit on Mars.
Wow. Sold. Yeah.
Yes. And it's wonderful. And the writing is beautiful. So those are my two suggestions.
Love that. Thank you, Victor. And the book is called Lone Women.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review. And check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.